I am Public Investor 12-03894, found in bad faith for telling truths Wall Street wants covered up. I prefer being called Six-Pack Sally, swinging at low-hanging fruit on Wall Street. And over the course of 9 years, after the Securities and Exchange Commission asked me to be their investment client whistleblower, a victim of Don J. Bennett, the hoodoo investment advisor, she was found guilty on all 17 counts as charged. Me? Well, I became a voice for investment clients and a voice for good investment advisors. Today's a little bit different, but I get back to Wall Street by the end, always. History repeats. Unless you've lived it before, you wouldn't know it. Sometimes, written words that catch up with us are just that, words written, telling a version of a story it will take digging to know. I'm a digger. I dig docks. I get to where the meat has left the bones, so to speak. I'm a whistleblower. History is my life engine. I relish in patterns of a Wordle like never seen before. Wordle is solved in minutes, while crimes, financial crimes, take reading, facts, connecting dots, and then sometimes walking around the corner at a coincidental time, just the way Reese and Peanut Butter Cups came to be. You haven't heard? Would you like to? Here, that is. Well, Mr. Reese's was coming around the corner holding a pot of open melted chocolate. Mr. Pieces was walking around the corner holding his peanut butter when, lo and behold, they crashed into each other. Mr. Pieces' peanut butter fell into Mr. Reese's chocolate pot, and lo and behold, today we put on pandemic pounds eating the what the world knows today as Reese's Pieces. Now, if you believe that, then you understand how easily our world has slipped to where we are today. Everything old became new again. We didn't see it coming. Few know history, more so in a world where algorithms are played with to see what we are wanted to see and not what is hidden away. Our world is cuckoo right now. It was cuckoo once before, almost a century ago. Mega huge corporations. We know today the Ford, the IBM, the General Electrics were in bed with someone's, a political, multinational thruple, so to speak, and a pimp of sorts, the Rockefellers, better known as Standard Oil, and their antitrust monopoly. They were pulling strings for almost 100 years. Years ago from where we are today. 1946. Not a good year. World War II just ended. Nazis. The Rockefeller Foundation was in bed with the Nazis. General Electric, the company, was in federal court on charges of violating antitrust law. Not their first time, nor their last. The United States government charged General Electric and a corporate ally with conspiracy to monopolize market, to raise prices and drive out their competition. Sounding familiar, isn't it? The United States government charged General Electric of criminal conspiracy with German major munitions firm Krupp. So together, Krupp and General Electric partnered to use fakery to raise the cost of United States defense preparations at the same time they were helping Hitler subsidize Germany's rearmament after Nazis smashed their tanks into Poland. Now, if it was just General Electric doing this homeland backstabbery, that would be one thing, but other American corporations were spooning with Nazi Germany too. Kodak, DuPont, General Motors, Ford, and Shell Oil. Shell Oil? Think Allies, think Brits. 1939, General Motors and Ford, German subsidiaries, controlled 70% of the German automobile market. War broke out in 1939. General Motors and Ford, well, those companies retooled themselves to be suppliers of war material to the German army. An observer said, when American GIs invaded Europe, June 1944, they did so in jeeps, trucks, and tanks manufactured by the big three motor companies in one of the largest crash militarization programs ever undertaken. It came as an unpleasant surprise to discover the enemy was also driving trucks manufactured by Ford and Opel, a 100% General Motors-owned subsidiary. And flying Opel built warplanes. Now, earlier in the 1920s, 1930s, America's major United States automakers, including Chrysler, set up multinational operation plants in Germany, Eastern Europe, and Japan. Multinational corporate operations was an idea pushed by Rockefeller Foundation-funded universities. General Motors and Ford were vital to the Nazi war effort. Coincidence? I think not. We think Ford, we think American classics, the cars. But there was more to Ford Americans were not told. News did not come as part of a Ford car owner's package that Henry Ford was a notorious anti-Semite with a mutual admiration society with Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was infatuated with America's mass production techniques. Hitler said, "I regard Henry Ford as my inspiration," and so much so that Hitler kept a life-size caricature of Henry Ford next to his desk. 1938, Ford, the American industrialist, accepted the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, Nazi Germany's highest award Hitler could give a foreigner. Ford played a role in Nazi Germany's pre-war military buildup. Well, as much as Ford wished differently, he was a foreigner, and all he would ever get was the Grand Cross of the German Eagle. And if one award to Americans was not enough, Hitler gave a General Motors senior executive a medal too, apparently for services rendered and services to come. It came. General Motors was most important to the Nazi war machine. General Motors was integral to the German war effort, more important to the Nazi war machine than Switzerland was, said researcher Bradford Snell. Snell said Switzerland was just a repository of looted funds, while General Motors, the Nazis could have invaded Poland and Russia without Switzerland. The Nazis could not have invaded Poland and Russia without General Motors. 1935, General Motors opened a truck factory near Berlin, and within enough time, General Motors' Berlin truck factory began producing trucks for German army convoys that would rumble through the Soviet Union, through France, and through Poland. Germany's Ford was the Nazis' military second largest producer of trucks for their Nazi military. General Motors' Germany plants built thousands of bomber and jet fighter propulsion systems for the Luftwaffe, at the same time producing aircraft engines for the United States Army Air Corps. What do you think of that? Working both sides, all sides of the war, is nothing new for American industrialists. IBM was taking U.S. military-developed, U.S. taxpayer-funded technology to count. Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to count. Not apples, not oranges, but people going to their death. This U.S.-funded technology was used to count. The Allies used the technology to count. The enemy used the same technology American taxpayers paid for. The Nazis used it to count. Well, it's sort of like today with the internet, which is used by America's enemies, but Americans paid for that technology too. IBM technology is how the U.S. military knew where to locate Japanese Americans to lock them up in the homeland here during World War II. The technology was how the Nazis could count all the Jews, gypsies, blacks, unfits, and others the Nazis removed from their homes into killing camps. It was the Nazi decision to not count once the undesired, the unfit, were shipped out on trains to the death camps. Victims that escaped the death trains, as you guess, were not missed when the death carriers arrived at the death camps. Without IBM technology counting them, the prisoners were not arrested. Some lived to tell. 1938, the United States Army Intelligence reported Ford's real purpose in opening a Ford truck assembly plant was to produce troop transport type vehicles for the German military, the Wehrmacht. The 3 years between 1935 to 1938 is a long time when you measure it in American lives lost fighting the Nazi enemy. 3 years is even longer when you realize boys from Detroit, a big Ford city, were being killed by enemy driving hometown vehicles that their hometown industry savior Ford was working both sides of the war with. That the kid Henry Ford said hello to today may be that same kid killed tomorrow by Nazi slime driving a Henry Ford truck. Hometown boys that died for God and country. 1939, Germany occupied Czechoslovakia. General Motors plants in Germany were very profitable. And with no conscience, General Motors chairman Alfred P. Sloan said, "We have no right to shut down that plant," meaning the Berlin plant. Sloan said the Nazis' behavior should not be considered the business of the management of General Motors. General Motors trucks were being used for tyranny. He said that was not a General Motors problem. History is best understood, sadly, only after government papers get declassified. The government is in no rush to let the cat out of their military bag too soon. Declassification can take 50 to 75 plus years, long enough to push past statutes and boundaries. Years later, 1974, long enough for the newer generation to lose connection to history and not care. It was their parents' world, not their world. It was their grandparents' world, not their world. Well, today it is their world. But back to 1974, the Senate Judiciary Committee issued a report. The report read, "The outbreaks of war in September 1939 resulted inevitably in the full conversion by General Motors and Ford of their Axis plants to the production of military aircraft and trucks." The report said, on the ground, General Motors and Ford subsidiaries built nearly 90% of the armored mule 3-ton half-trucks and more than 70% of the Reich's medium and heavy-duty trucks. 31 years too late, American intelligence reports said. These American vehicles served as the backbone of the German army transportation system that the Nazis could not have invaded Poland and Russia without. Could not have invaded Poland and Russia without General Motors. So you know how it goes with people who get their hands caught in the cookie jar. It's always somebody else's fault, not theirs. And to this day, the American company officials insist Hitler and Hitler's Nazi government took over the American auto plants in Germany, that the Nazis did it, whatever the it was, that it was not the fault of the American auto officials of Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and others. Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, and others officials insist they lost control of the situation. And so they delayed history. They hid history in classified papers. And long enough until they were declassified, nobody really cared. And the papers showed the American managers of General Motors and Ford were up to their elbow grease in the conversion of American auto plants for Nazi military production. So American GIs liberating Ford auto plants in Cologne and Berlin found plant workers from foreign places hungry, dirty, imprisoned behind barbed wire. American GIs found American German company documents extolling the virtuous brilliance of the Führer. American GIs, maybe even some from Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors hometowns. Shocking. Just shocking. Not as shocking enough as learning to this date not one of these companies is yet brought to trial for doing business with the enemy during wartime, much like it is still to this day the way things are with American companies in China, in the Ukraine, in Russia. These war criminals' secret sauce is simply forming a partnership with the enemy company, hence technically it's not an American company, nor an enemy company, rather a bastard child of another mother brother, so to speak. And if that wasn't disgusting enough, both General Motors and Ford demanded reparations from the United States government for damage done to the trader companies, their trader companies in Germany that were harmed by Allied bombing. It can't get crazier than this, but it does. 1967, the United States government paid out $33 million of taxpayer dollars of money from families who lost boys over there in the Rhineland for Germany's American Rüsselsheim plant. $33 million. Have you ever seen a menu of death? A military menu of how much a body part and life are worth? They're not marked $33 million. Not at all. General Electric was different and deeper in bed in a different way. They had a complicated relationship with the Third Reich regime. Going back to 1904, General Electric was playing footsie with foreign competition. They were playing under the bed covers to see who would be top or bottom towards carving up the world for their goods and technologies markets. Sounds familiar? That same year, 1904, General Electric came to agreement with AEG, Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, the worker union in Germany. And the next year after that, General Electric solidified their relationship with Tokyo Electric. World War I sort of got in the middle of General Electric plans to ally with German firms. The disruption was temporary for them. General Electric took over 16% of AEG stock. General Electric installed four of its officials onto the board of Allgemeine Elektrizitäts Gesellschaft, Germany's big electrical manufacturing company, and General Electric got stake in Siemens too. Siemens was Germany's other big electrical manufacturing company. And when it came to General Electric protecting General Electric's domestic market, General Electric forged ahead to gain access to German and Japanese corporate foreign markets, their patent agreements, and obtaining minority stock ownership with each. Sort of like what's going on today in the Ukraine, maybe. What dragged General Electric into a New York courtroom impacting the United States war effort was General Electric's conspiracy with Krupp, the German steel company. Krupp and General Electric had patents for the hard metal composition tungsten carbide. Krupp and General Electric used tungsten carbide for tool and die work, machining metal and cutting dies. Alone, neither company had patents enough to monopolize the world. Together, Krupp and General Electric could dominate the globe. 1928, April. General Electric and Krupp held talks. General Electric's representative said his company entering new business depended on the extent to which they can discourage competition. General Electric and Krupp were teaming up, WWE style, to knock their competition out of the ring. Hulk Hogan, Dave Bautista style. Knock him out. 8 months later, General Electric and Krupp were in bed, business style. General Electric had cleared the runway to fix prices. General Electric had set up a separate subsidiary, a dummy corporation, to flow business through unchecked. The company? Carbaloy. Oh, the price of tungsten carbide took off from $48 to $453 a pound. The same way Martin Shkreli did after buying rights to Daraprim, the anti-parasitic drug used to treat infection that occurs in some AIDS, malaria, and cancer patients. General Electric used their agreement with Krupp to get rid of their American domestic competition, like American Cutting Alloys. American Cutting Alloys president begged General Electric to let American Cutting Alloys stay in business. American Cutting Alloys was told by a General Electric official, "It seems rather obvious to me that five suppliers in the American market, all supplying carbides, is a better situation than six suppliers." As cold-blooded as that. In its agreement with Krupp, General Electric agreed to sell tungsten carbide, also known as Carbaloy, only in the Western Hemisphere, and to pay royalties to Krupp. Gustav Krupp, owner of the company, was a major corporate backer of Adolf Hitler. Both before and after Hitler's rise to power, General Electric's royalties indirectly subsidized the Nazis. 1935. The United States government started war defense preparations. Tungsten carbide at General Electric prices were too expensive. 1939, December 11th, 9 weeks after Hitler attacked Poland, International General Electric cabled from Berlin to General Electric's Dr. Zay Jeffries. The cable said, "Our friends at Osram Company informed me yesterday that Krupp would be interested in capitalizing the royalties now being received from Carbaloy. And in this connection, Dr. Louis, a Krupp official, has asked for an appointment with me in Zurich, where we shall both be next week. They are anxious that the Krupp name be kept out of correspondence, particularly telegrams that might reach improper hands. And therefore, I shall refer to them in the future as the European licensor under Carbaloy contract, or simply as Dr. Louis." Osram Company is a German lighting company linked to General Electric, to GE. 1948. The UE News said the improper hands could either be the United States government or the governments of Europe which had been attacked by Hitler. That General Electric agreed to protect the Nazis. UE News is the United Electrical Workers trade magazine. So in 1940, with the American defense moves in full swing, General Electric was still reporting to the Nazi representatives now stationed in Zurich, in Switzerland, how much tungsten carbide was being used in the United States. And General Electric paid royalties to the Nazis on every pound used here. That was money for the Hitler war chest. That was money for the Hitler war chest. Oh, Hitler, through Krupp, was getting paid royalties and every pound of materials sold in the United States of America. And Hitler then took that money and used it to buy more munitions with. Hitler was buying 12 pounds of tungsten carbide at the price the United States government was buying 1 pound. And for every pound of material sold in the United States, Hitler, through Krupp, was getting royalties in which he bought more munitions. Sounding familiar, isn't it? Like with fuel, gas. Isn't it? And with Europe at war in 1940, Krupp coordinated with General Electric to have Krupp's royalties from General Electric collected by a Swiss go-between. 1940, August, a year after Hitler attacked Poland, General Electric was looking to renew its monopoly agreement with Krupp. The United States government clamped an embargo on shipment of money to the Nazis. The General Electric-Krupp deal ended, and a lawsuit was filed. The Firth Sterling Steel Company complained to the United States Department of Justice Department, to the DOJ. The Firth Sterling Steel Company wanted to sell shell-turning blanks to the United States Army, to Frankfurt Arsenal. The Firth Sterling Steel Company ran into trouble with General Electric's price levels, so Firth Sterling Steel complained. 1940, the UE News in September reported two federal antitrust indictments were returned against General Electric and the Krupp Company. General Electric and the Krupp Company were charged with conspiracy to maintain worldwide monopoly in the production and sale of tungsten carbide. The proceedings were interrupted. The United States of America entered World War II. The Senate subcommittee of the Senate Committee frowned on international cartels interfering the anti-fascist war effort. The subcommittee charged the General Electric Krupp arrangement was strangling American production of tungsten carbide. It's sounding familiar, isn't it? Isn't it? John Henry Lewin, special assistant to the Attorney General, said, in contrast with the situation in Germany, the need to produce it, to retool our manufacturing plants with it, and to instruct workmen in the use of such tools has constituted one of the principal bottlenecks in our production program. General Electric had crippled manufacturing of tungsten carbide in America. There was no tungsten carbide for military needs. Well, today there's no gas for law officers to drive around with. Sounding familiar, isn't it? Independent manufacturers were gone, much like Amazon in our world markets today, killed off the competition. Much like lack of baby formula in America, dried up, is being blamed on Russia's war with the Ukraine. History does, you see, history does repeat. 1947, January 26, the General Electric Krupp trial restarted in New York. General Electric's Vice President Zay Jeffries, President of Carbaloy Company W.G. Robbins, and Walter M. Stearns, former General Electric trade manager, were indicted. General Electric's Gustav Krupp was held as a war criminal in Germany. Krupp was not present at the trial. Not to worry. Krupp was indicted. General Electric's Vice President Zay Jeffries accused the United Electric leaders of un-American objectives. Jeffries denounced they're asking for higher wages. Is it sounding familiar yet? Is it? What took place then was the reset. The reset we are experiencing today. History repeats. General Electric's attorneys fought to keep the German documents seized by the U.S. military from being introduced in trial. In one such document, indicted General Electric conspirator Walter Stearns was quoted as telling the Germans that while General Electric intended to fix prices, this must never be expressed in the contract itself or in any correspondence which might come into the files of General Electric. The court heard testimony of American companies pressured by General Electric not to buy tungsten carbide from General Electric competitors. The president of Union Wire, Dye, told the court Dr. Jeffries warned him, "We'll either buy you out or break you." The court found General Electric, its subsidiaries, and company officials guilty on 5 counts of criminal conspiracy, with Friedrich Krupp, AG of Essen, Germany. Judge John Knox said, "Competitors were excluded by purchase and by boycott. Prices on unpatented products were fixed. Future patent rights were forced into the pool. World markets were divided, and on occasion, prices were fixed beyond the scope of any asserted patent protection." Judge Knox said, "The defendants did unlawfully monopolize." Even though the profits General Electric made through its conspiracy with Krupp, they must have run into many millions of dollars. Former General Electric trade manager Walter M. Stearns and General Electric's vice president Zay Jeffries, they were fined $2,500 each. That's $2,500 each. Carbaloy Company president W.G. Robbins was fined $1,000. General Electric was fined $20,000. Carbaloy was fined $20,000. And International General Electric was fined $10,000. The Justice Department wanted heavy penalties and jail time, but Judge Knox's court said no. He slapped the wrists of General Electric and Krupp with a wet noodle. The companies had made millions upon millions. The lives of Americans were lost. And the judge said no. Everything comes full circle, though. Welcome to my world. I am the SEC-requested financial client whistleblower, the Securities and Exchange Commission-requested financial client whistleblower. I know why. I know how this fraud happens. I've been exposing these type of frauds since 2010. The fix has been in since Jekyll Island, early 1900s. The fix was in from the get-go, except this was World War II. Nazis were tried at Nuremberg trial. Nazis were tried at other trials, hung, shot, imprisoned for life, and longer or less. Some took the easy way out, some Nazis did. They killed themselves, suicide. But not the Americans. The Nazis at Nuremberg asked, "Why not the Americans? What about the Americans? The Americans were in this too." Good questions never answered until now. The Americans ran the scam, repeating it today. 1935, in 1936 alone, Carbaloy had a profit of $694,000. On top of that, Carbaloy, General Electric subsidiary, paid General Electric a manufacturing profit of $454,000, along with $300,000 interest on a loan it got from General Electric during their industry monopoly. News is, reports on the trial and convictions were buried by newspapers. We know why. David Rockefeller got caught on a secret recording that was leaked in 1991. We know why. David Rockefeller was at a meeting of the Council of Foreign Relations. Rockefeller told the gathered the Rockefeller Foundation agenda was being accomplished because media was on board and Hollywood. The United Electric Worker News reported on the trial consistently. Others did not. And then, as today, big business, international cartel agreements working against America, against Americans, hindered the working people of America who patriotically were giving their all, including their sons, their men, to the then anti-fascist war effort, same as we do today. History repeats again. Difference this time being, as the SEC, Securities and Exchange requested financial client whistleblower, who exposed why the little guy gets served up while the big business gets away with murder. I explained with you this is business as usual, plotted out decades ago. Nothing new going on here. Look again. No history. I am Public Investor 12-03894, found in bad faith for telling truths Wall Street wants covered up. I prefer being called Six-Pack Sally, swinging at low-hanging fruit on Wall Street. And over the course of 9 years after the Securities and Exchange Commission employees asked me to be their investment client whistleblower, a victim of Don J. Bennett, the hoodoo investment advisor, she was found guilty on all 17 counts as charged. And I stay a voice for investment clients, a voice for good investment advisors, a voice for you. Be good, be well, be back. Make it a good one.